Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another podcast for The Diplomat and the Beyond the Mekong series. And with me today is Andy Pendleton, who has been knocking around Southeast Asia, Middle East, Africa for the last 40 years, where he's worked for the United Nations, mainly in refugee and humanitarian assistance. Andy, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Luke. It's good to be here with you.
How many countries have you worked in? War-torn countries, the countries that the world's dispossessed and the harshest hit.
11 altogether, actually. Right. When I left Cambodia, the emergency times were basically over, and my skill set, I decided to take it elsewhere. And while I hated to leave Cambodia, I certainly had my horizons raised in Africa. Right. It's a whole new kettle of fish, so to speak.
Coming back to Cambodia, you were here earlier than most people that I've met over the decades. You arrived in the border areas with Thailand in 1979. The Khmer Rouge had just been ousted from power and they were up on that border area and there was a great famine.
That's right, and one of the most ironic things about 1979 and 80 in the famine years, that the first famine-stricken people that we saw crossing the border were in fact Khmer Rouge-based people. Right. It was the Vietnamese army that had pushed them against the Cardamom and the Dong Rek mountain ranges, and basically it blockaded food and they starved them off. So the first starving refugees, famine-stricken children, the photos that swept around the world and caught world attention were in fact the Khmer Rouge-based people. A bit of irony in itself, but that's not to say that they harmed others. Of course, the regime certainly did.
Yeah, it was very well documented over the years to come through the tribunal. From Cambodia, you went to Africa. What are the similarities between a lot of these countries? And I say that with some prejudice, in that back in those days, towards the end of the Cold War, there was this idealistic expectation that these countries could be made better.
Well, we'll start with the 79-80 famine. It was the largest relief effort in history to date. And Cambodia, with the signing of the Paris Peace Accords, that was also the largest and the first United Nations operation called UNTAC, United Nations Transitional Authority of Cambodia. And it was a huge operation with 23,000 soldiers and an adjoining 14,000 administrators and field officers. It was a big effort. It was probably never had been successful had the Cambodian people not wanted it themselves. Right. And I believe that was the key to it. And perhaps the turning point of some African countries. You've just got to want it. And yourself, the people have to want it and to make it so, because foreigners coming into situations like this, trying to turn them over and make them better, it's a pretty tough act to do.
Did you ever see this as a kind of neo-form of colonialism? I mean, it's the sort of thing people talk about with the great benefit of hindsight, but what else do you do when the country is on its knees? And in Cambodia's case, it was a failed state.
Well, I mean, I think that we have a moral responsibility to respond to them on a basis of need, not necessarily along any, not on political, racial, religious, social group, on a basis of need, with concentration and targeting of your under five children that are the first to go and the most malnourished, and work your way up from there. And we try to target the vulnerable and make that part of the population at least, because, you know, the first thing on the Thai-Cambodian border I noticed is there weren't any old people and there weren't any young people. They had all died off.
Yeah, there was once a saying from back in those days, if you'd like to know what war is like, talk to the surviving grandmothers.
Yeah, war is hell.
So, yeah. What were the biggest obstacles? And I've known people who have worked in the United Nations before, and it can be notorious for its bureaucracy, political correctness, I guess wokeness these days. But what got in the way, and how did you fix those problems?
Well, it used to be when you went to the worst spots on the planet, you had a way of distancing yourself or putting distance between you and the kind of people that you'd rather not work with, the kind of competitors and the kiss-up, kick-downs. But with the population growing the way it is and so many people wanting to be in the United Nations, it's hard to escape. Even in the worst war zones of the world, there's always a few people that are out for their own interest. And in fact, that's what's changed in relief work. Plato said, youth is wasted on the young, and I feel pretty old just saying that, but I mean, we were idealistic, but at least money wasn't the thing that drove us, nor our own personal self-promotion. Something's different now. It's very different. And as idealistic as we were, in hindsight, I'm thinking it could have been done a little bit better and a little bit differently, but that's always 2020 in hindsight, right, Luke?
Yeah, that's right. The obstacles were one thing. When it comes to competition, there were competing NGOs, and NGOs were very much a byproduct that emerged with the end of the Cold War. It was one way in which governments, through sponsoring these agencies, could get a toehold in a lot of countries which had been left on the sideline by the Cold War. Mm. Have the NGOs had their day in terms of how they were 10, 20, 30 years ago? Do we need a different model in terms of helping those who need it?
Well, in terms of international support and funding for non-government organizations and the UN, it's dropped in half. World outreach and response to all the great tragedy of the world are small in comparison to the biggest operations that the UN has led. It's just losing funding, and there's so many countries that are suffering with famine and economic collapse and internal displacement, external migration. It's a mess. The world is in a state of crisis, and I really believe that.
How different is the African experience to what you witnessed in Southeast Asia?
Africa is so incredibly desperate. When you see children come out of the bush with no clothes and skinny as a rail, and it's just, you realize that the aid and the funding that Southeast Asia got was, despite it all, was actually quite abundant. And it continued for many, many years. The attention, the funding, it sustained itself for many, many years. Africa just didn't get that. And now Africa is falling to pieces. All the eastern part of Africa is just falling economically, internal strife, political unrest. It's just a mess.
From a distance, we hear these stories about proxy wars being fought in East Africa, and that the Russians, this sort of policy of disrupt, 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 seems to be playing a hand in that part of the world. How much truth is there to that? Are the Russians really that involved, or is it, it's always been like this?
I can say that 40 years ago, all across Africa, the cities were no more than a couple of stories. They were just small little cities with poor road networks, and all across Africa, all of its major capitals have turned into miniature Tokyos with skyscrapers and bridges and beautiful roads. It's a complete change, a complete economic upward gain in many ways, and skyscrapers and bridges and roads all across Africa. And here in Phnom Penh as well, it's Chinese money.
But you still have this great juxtaposition against the poverty and the realities of conflict. Exactly. It just doesn't seem to go away.
Exactly. You know, it unfortunately seems like a sort of a cancerous wound, and we keep applying these band-aids to them, and there's lots of rhetoric about addressing the root causes and so on, but it seems like it always falls just a bit short of that.
You've spent much of your time in these agencies being responsible for security. You've got through the
humanitarian affairs,
and through the associations and groups that you work with, you have quite a few people running around out there doing their work, including places like Myanmar, which has been in the headlines with the great rout of the military by the opposition over the last couple of weeks. What's your advice for people, kids, the young people heading into these countries where, you know, they're still idealistic, many of them want to make a change, and they're heading out into countries which are very dangerous?
Well, I mean, you've got to make a decision. Why do you want to be there, and what do you want to do there? Mm-hmm. And what are your goals, and what are your personal goals? If you have career goals in these things, I mean, that's one thing. But as a relief worker, I mean, yeah, everyone can have a career goal. But I mean, the goal is to help others and to do it in a genuine way. And this sort of competition career is just something that I wish we weren't all faced with, but it seems to be everywhere now. Mm-hmm. And without the funding and money, I see it making a downward spiral and not addressing the humongous relief needs right now. I mean, from Gaza to Sudan, to South Sudan, across the eastern seaboard, you know, it just seems like a mess from Ethiopia, Mozambique, on down to Somalia. It's just really messed. And you can move into the West Coast from Cameroon and across that whole area. It's also a silent cry, a desperation that we hear very little about. But yet the plight of these people is horrific.
Is the UN doing enough? You're not with the UN these days.
No,
you're with
I'm retired.
You're retired. What's changed within the UN? And when one looks back at, say, the 1990s, their efforts in Cambodia, here in Phnom Penh, mm-hmm. East Timor, Somalia, but the UN tried. It pumped lots of money into lots of countries which were beaten down, and it didn't always work.
No.
And the results were mixed.
Mm.
But at least they tried, and I don't see that coming out of the United Nations these days.
Well, I think, you know, we've got to look at the voting members of the UN. I mean, they raise their hands and they say we choose in a democratic way. They raise their hands and choose to do it this way or that way, and it's up to that majority to decide where and how it goes, and including the funding, which is also drying up very quickly in face of a world crisis. So I think we're at a desperate juncture here.
In terms of a global crisis and the UN, Israel and Gaza and the Ukraine and Russia seem to preoccupy all its spare time. Is that taken away from a lot of other countries that are in need? And
Absolutely. I think it's shifted attention, funding, and what little funding is available. It's just reduced it, spread it out, and it's just not really working so well.
All right. What would you do if you were in charge?
Well, it's going to need a whole lot more attention and funding and money and strategic goals where a government can stand on its own feet and be able to pull itself up by its own bootstraps and take care of its own people. And that's the only way it's going to work.
Is there a role for militaries in this? UN peacekeepers, like what happened here and in East Timor, they tried with Somalia. But that seems to be very much out of vogue these days. The one group of people that can bring in the humanitarian assistance and restore order is a military.
Well, I think that, as we've seen in the past, the Department of Peacekeeping Operations is a very expensive group. And even Cambodia has its own participatory soldiers involved, and they're quite professional, including the D-miners. So these contributing nations to the DPKO, Department of Peacekeeping Operations, I think it's important. And yes, having an armed force on the ground in the case of a Chapter 4 or Chapter 7 is necessary, I think.
Chapter 4 and Chapter 7
being when a country calls the UN to intervene, and when a country, the latter being 7, when a country falls completely to pieces, and it's the Security Council and the UN voting body decides to go in itself and sort of take control again. That's much rarer than a chapter 4.
what are some current examples of a chapter 4 or 7?
Oh, I think Sudan. I don't know if I haven't followed it very closely, but it's certainly got to be close to a chapter four. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very, very desperate. But I mean, you can declare these things all day and night, but you can need the money for these massive aid operations and to bring peace in a sustainable way. It's very expensive, and maybe we have an opportunity to look back on what's failed and what's succeeded in this respect.
There's also donor fatigue in that the politicians
Absolutely.
In the West who answer to their constituency.
Absolutely.
It's not always winning them votes. And I remember in
exactly.
back in the 1990s when Kofi Annan would announce the annual appeal for Afghanistan. Mm. And I think it was about $120 million a year.
Right.
And then after about 9 months, maybe $20 million had been promised.
Right.
And then the 12-month deadline would fall. And then about 3 months after that, he would come out and announce that these countries that had promised money hadn't paid.
Mm.
And it created all sorts of issues with funding and trying to get projects done.
Well, the so-called pledges versus actually handing the money over. These two, I mean, sometimes pledges are made for political reasons and filibuster reasons. And pledges are certainly different than handing over the money. So one's a pledge and one is actually following through with what you promised. So they can be quite different in the end of the day.
All right. And so when you're reading headlines coming out after a natural disaster that this country has pledged $100 million or we're going to do right. A, B, C, or D, it's not always forthcoming?
Not always, and it's not, you can't generalize, but yes, in fact, that often happens where pledges don't follow through all the way.
Mm-hmm. 1979 in Cambodia, it's a fascinating period because the Vietnamese had just left. You were on the border.
Mm.
How far in were you coming at that point, and what was your relationship with the Khmer Rouge? How did you find them as a group of people to deal with?
Well, they had a group of women called the Mut Neri, and they had pixie haircuts, and they were the backbone of the Khmer Rouge, and we see them carry comrades over the hill and drop into the valley below in places like Klong Gai Tuen or Lam Wap, when 75, 25 died a day. And the Khmer Rouge were told us that they hadn't done anything. And in fact, it was the Vietnamese that had done that. And as young relief workers, we learned to speak the Khmer Rouge revolutionary dialect, thinking it was the standard Cambodian dialect.
Mm-hmm.
And when I moved to the so-called non-communist camp, someone said to me, "Oh, you're speaking the revolutionary Khmer Rouge dialect. You speak differently." And we realized then, in camps like My Root and Gamput, which were almost entirely Khmer Rouge, they were all combined in another camp called Khao I Dang, and I'll never forget the day they left. Tens of thousands of black pajamas and Pol Pot sandals and Mao hats were thrown and discarded in the sand as they were all trucked from My Root and Gamput and consolidated in Khao I Dang. They didn't want to be seen as Khmer Rouge anymore. Places like My Root and Gamput and Kap Chung all had old camps, which were always Khmer Rouge. And I talk about Khmer Rouge based people, you know. It's difficult to say Khmer Rouge or whatever. In fact, we always called them Democratic Kampuchea, to be more neutral. But
it's a pretty broad term. I mean,
it's true. It's a pretty broad term.
And half the government is made up of former Khmer Rouge, defectors or otherwise, and then tribunal. Categorize the Khmer Rouge, it was their call, but it takes in a lot more people than I think a lot of people would recognize.
Well, I think the thing in relative terms or comparative terms we'll say worked out pretty well. The tribunal, I mean, something was done. And the whole transition towards peace and stability in Cambodia, I mean, the contrast between now and when I was here 23 years ago is just amazing.
Right.
Amazing. Nothing short of amazing. Even the mood of the people, the way they act and smile, it's a different place, a different society, and a new generation is taking over here. It's quite something to see.
Myanmar, it's a difficult conflict to read because it's such a patchwork of EAOs, the ethnic... Right. organizations and the PDF and the politics of the NUG. What's your approach? I'd asked your reading on the subject, but I know you're a little reticent on that one, but I'm going to ask anyway.
Yeah. Well, we march things in phases, and we can move them internally and try to move them externally, move them away from fighting areas to safe houses and so on. And we've put together a very succinct but detailed preparedness and response plan. So we do the best we can with what we've got, and it's just a mess in there. It's kind of hard to do remote programming or use the 10,000 kilometer screwdriver to repair anything. I mean, staff have got to take care of themselves, so to speak.
What are they actually doing on the ground when they go to work? What are they trying to do? Because my guess is that a lot of them will be having a few days off at the moment. What are they doing when they go to work every day, if they can?
They're trying to do community building and help communities just concentrate on vulnerable groups and working with communities to help themselves.
So looking at food, water, basically.
Whatever they can do in a limited way, actually, yes.
Right. I think it's become obvious that the junta can't win in Myanmar.
Mm.
What would be a political outcome that might be acceptable over the longer period?
It's so complicated. I just to bring peace, I hate to see it all broke up along ethnic lines. I'd like to just see peace and prosperity come to the place. It just seems such a chronic issue.
Mm.
It just there seems to be no end to it, and I'm just hoping that somehow peace and stability will somehow find its way back in. But it appears to be getting a lot worse before it gets better, that's for sure.
All right. And you marched into your 70s, you're fit.
I don't know about that. Anyway.
I can't imagine you retiring. I can't see that.
Probably. It's but probably not too far off. You know, I'm just getting old.
What would you do over the longer term?
Write. I'd like to come back to Cambodia and see friends. And if I had a way, if the global crisis can cool down a little bit, I'd like to make a global tour and see all the places I've worked and shake hands with all the people that managed to survive through it.
What were the favorites?
I really like Kurdistan and Iraq. I like Afghanistan as well. Very wholesome people. In Liberia and Sierra Leone, they were also challenges, but it was also great to be there. Northern Uganda, the so-called Lord's Resistance Army, that's a mess. And then I was in Darfur for 5.5 years, and South Sudan for 3 years, and Iraq and Afghanistan. So it was a full spectrum of war and fighting, death and misery, and pain and politics.
Have you had to deal with PTSD over the years? A lot of people have.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And when I get in another war situation, it doesn't seem to be there. But afterwards, perhaps, my dreaming and handling certain situations that might be completely abstract and different to that, an artillery shell or gun firing next to your ear. I mean, that doesn't seem to bother me that much, actually. But after, it does have an accumulative effect. And I think little things like worrying about supporting my family, personal finances, et cetera, it kind of creeps up on you. So you got to take care of your own mental health and physical health and then try to exercise. I mean, I say all that, but that's what I'm trying to do.
Not drink too much.
That's right.
So that should help.
It should help.
It's a cure.
Old friends like you is a cure.
With PTSD, it can be a kind of beguiling type of thing in that it's the smallest things that can set you off. And no one else can see it coming. Even you can't see it coming.
Well, it doesn't. I don't have these things setting me off. What it happens, I mean, I think it's just wore me down. And I don't get aggressive with it or anything like that. I just get depressed. So I have to be careful.
Right. Kurdistan is always an interesting spot. It was like the one group of people that should have been a country that missed out.
I think you're so right about that.
And its relationship with Iraq and also Turkey is...
Very interesting, isn't it?
Is that...
Well, I thought they were very genuine, very humble, and very generous. So I really like Kurdistan and my time there. I was setting up the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs and got a lot of cooperation from the government, from the UN agencies. Just everybody pitched in and were happy to see me, and we all worked together in a coordinated fashion. So it's not always the case. I was kind of pleased with that, yeah.
Bring it back to Cambodia. Your Khmer is still excellent. Thai's pretty good.
Yeah, it's probably gone down quite a lot over the years.
You've still got a lot of people in country who you worked with decades ago.
Yes, absolutely. Lots of friends.
How are they faring these days?
I think prosperity's here, and I think a lot of them have sold land. They're driving Lexus. I mean, we're talking about refugees that were in grass huts, and now they're back in Cambodia in three-story houses on riverfront properties, so on and so forth. It's incredible to see. We're talking about refugees that have lots of money and were smart with it and went from rags to riches in selling land and rode Cambodia's economic growth by the coattails. And it's amazing to see them pick you up at the airport in a brand new Lexus or go over to their house, which is a 3 or 4 story beautiful home with a garden. It's just like, hey, these are the same guys that were living in grass huts just about 40 years ago. It's just amazing to watch. Not that that's so incredible, but it's nice to see prosperity and see them comfortable with their children and their families, and there's not war around, and they can go out without fear of being shot or harmed, and it's just nice to see.
I mean, what you were saying earlier about, you know, the world in crisis kind of point, which is being made by many others as well, is that given the events of the last 20, 30 years, which is responsible for where we are,
right,
Cambodia is not too bad off.
Yeah, I would have to say it's found its path, and it's doing very well, I have to say.
Where do you think the countries that you're working in, East Africa, Southeast Asia,
has there's much less promise in these countries than you see in Southeast Asia or see in Cambodia. I mean, you just don't have that economic drive that, I mean, there's a patriotic feeling back in Cambodia. Things have changed. You don't have that prospect. You don't have that possibility for many African countries. It just doesn't seem to be going anywhere but down.
Right. The outlook for East Africa remains bleak. Southeast Asia seems to be humming along from your perspective.
Yeah. From my limited knowledge, let's just say, it seems to be comparatively doing quite well.
And your limited analysis is like 50 years. You've got more years.
I've seen so many countries that are in desperate straits right now, serious desperate straits, and happy to see Cambodia is not one of them.
And as for the others, how do you crank up the interest in outside countries and the work, digital age, and getting people's attentions measured by the nanosecond?
Exactly.
Traditional media doesn't have the same influence that it once did.
Exactly.
How do you get that?
There's no doubt that the media and social media is such an incredible driving power of influence. I mean, let's just take Ethiopia, for example, and one would believe that the problem in Ethiopia was because of the government there, and that the Tigrayan, or the Tigrayan People's Defense Forces, TPDF, you know, they were the victims. But actually, it was, as they say in Cambodia, it takes two hands to hear a clap. It takes two to tango. And I can tell you the mess in Ethiopia is very much so from both sides. There are no saints there in this conflict, or in most any conflict. In the way the media shapes it, as if there's a black and white, there's a victim and there's a villain, it's not always that clear. And the influence of the international media drives aid and influences situations and across the globe on a political level. The media is just, I would say, media and social media. I've gone to countries and gotten a completely different idea from the media of what is actually going on there. So, you know, when I talk with people like Luke Hunt and all the bunches of journalists that were here in Cambodia, there was a lot of integrity involved there, and there was a lot of truth. And I have to say that you guys in Cambodia, all the journalists, they did a great job. And you just don't see that very often. You don't see it very often. So congratulations.
Thank you. I can't speak for everybody else, but I do know there were a lot of journalists who did try and did work very hard.
Really did. Really
and it's the way it was. Andy Pendleton, it's been a delight chatting with you. One final sentence, outlook for...
Well, I think we're all down to a personal sort of level about what happens next in this life on this planet. And I don't know, day by day and living moment by moment, trying to learn something from each one of those moments and trying not to make the same mistake I've made again and again, and trying to find hope in it all, and not so much reasoning things, but having faith that just the same, things will get better no matter what.
Andy Pendleton, thank you very much.
Thank you.